much. In San Luis Obispo. I'm going to read to you from the Black Book, the Book of X-Ray. The tormented rantings of a sex-crazed rock and roller. Actually, if anybody wants to go straight to the meaty parts, I suggest you read 365. That's an interesting page. But first of all, before we start this odyssey, I'd like to prime you all. You don't mind being primed, do you mind that? I want you to start thinking about a new century. No, not the boring 21st century. I'm talking about the last century. You see, because that has great bearing on the story we're going to hear tonight. You see, 100 years ago, that was when Great Britain had an empire. Well, at least you didn't laugh. Holy. There was a queen on the throne of England. Her name was Victoria. You see, clap your hands, Martha. Long ago, life was clean. Sex was bad and obscene. And the rich were so mean. Stately homes for the lost. Broken lawns, village greens. Victoria was my queen. Of a century which started at the height of class-conscious imperialism and ended with a society so reduced to totalitarian commonness that in my final years at school, the saying, mediocrity rises, became very popular. And being slightly mediocre myself, I rose. And you're not supposed to laugh at that. My generation has been taught to be so in touch with the latest fashion that we've become faceless. We're victims of design. But oddly enough, although I was taught to think of myself as a man with no face, somewhere inside this dark interior, I believe that one day, I'll become an individual. Thank you.
I was born in a welfare state, ruled by bureaucracy, controlled by civil servants and people dressed in gray. Got no privacy, I've got no liberty, because the 20th century people took it all away from me. This is the 20th century, too much aggravation. This is the age of insanity. What has become of the green dragon fields of Jerusalem? Ain't got no ambition, I'm just disillusioned. I'm a 20th century man, but I don't want.
Anyone listening to me speak will soon realize that I am not from Poso. I hear it's a really nice place. Now, I come from a place far across the water, thousands of miles away, a place called London, England, yes. In fact, I come from the northern suburbs. To the north of London, there are three hills and they look down over the city. The villages of Highgate, Hampstead, and Muswell Hill. Shout out to the Muswell Hill villages. And When I was a kid, my sister used to come home with stories of what it was like to go to the West End. West End is like Soho, the red light district. She was a lot older than me and she was allowed out. But even now I'm an adult, they still won't allow me out. They're very, very wise. Now, when I was a kid, my sister used to come home with these great stories of Soho. Stories about nightclubs, discotheques, the blues, hoodlums, beatniks, prostitutes. Sounds like she had a good time, my sister. And here's a story told to a child about this dark, mysterious metropolis on her doorstep, London. There's a room in a house, in a street, in a manor, in a borough that's part of the city that is generally referred to as London. It's a dark place, can be a mysterious place. And it's said that if you're born within the sound of Bow Bells, you have the necessary qualifications to be christened a Londoner. Yeah. Ah, but it's a hard, cruel, wicked place. When you think back to all the great Londoners, William Blake, Charles Dickens, Dick Whittington, Hurley Kings, Barrow Boys, Arthur Daly, Max Moore, the Praetorians. Through the dark alleyways and the passages of London, London. But if you're ever up on Highgate, see right down to Leicester Square, Crystal Palace, Clapham Common, right down to Stratton Hill. North and south, I feel that I'm a Londoner still. Crystal Palace, Newham and East End, church bells ring out through the land. You were born in London, England. There's a tap by a reservoir leading to a stream that turns into a river estuary that eventually opens to the sea. And there's a docker by a wharf sending cargo overseas, unloading foreign trade from a large ocean vessel in the mighty metropolitan port of London. And when I think of all the Londoners still out of sight, EastEnders, WestEnders, Oriental Enders, Fu Manchu, Sherlock Holmes, Jack Spot, Henry Cooper, Thomas Beckett, Thomas More. Don't forget the Cray Twins. Very dangerous people, the Cray Twins. There's a part of me that says get out, then one day I'll hear somebody shout. I recognise that accent. Sounds to me like you come from London town. But if you're ever up on Highgate Hill on a clear day, I'll be there. Yes. Family. I have five older sisters. Yes, I know. Very busy, my mum and dad. But it was wonderful to be the only family, the only boy in a family of girls, particularly as they were much older. When I was about 4 or 5 years old, the girls were already in their teens, so there's a big age difference. But as I said, it was paradise to be the only boy in that family. Completely doted on and spoiled. Until one day,
My mother surprised everybody, including my father, I think. At the ripe old age of 45, my mother gave birth to another baby boy. And his name was David. No applause is necessary. We'll hear more from him later. More than we care to admit. You think about those girls, those five sisters. They played all of their bebop records on the radiogram in the front room where we lived. The front room, obviously at the front of the house, but really it was the centre of our world, because every time we had an excuse, we'd have a party in the front room. Weddings, birthdays, funerals, christenings, you name it, everything. And in the corner of the front room was a little upright piano. And everybody in the family played the piano really badly. But the girls put on records by pop idols of their generation. People like Johnny Ray, Harry Comer, Joe Stafford, Les Paul and Mary Ford, and Kay Starr sang the Wheel of Fortune. And that was the first time I'd ever heard double tracking anywhere. There was a singer called Hank Williams who sang these great country songs, and a music hall ukulele player called George Fulby. Nobody really heard of over here, but he was very big in Blackpool. Sorry, it's Sunday night, don't do all that. They did all the latest dances, my sisters. They did dances with their latest boyfriends. And it's interesting to note that the dances they did resembled the various boyfriends. They did the creep, the smooch, the boogie-woogie, jive, right down to early rock and roll. One of my sisters had a record by a singer called Billy Eckstein. Now, Billy Eckstein was a black man with Jewish-sounding name. But that wasn't a problem. See, the real problem was that my mother refused to have this record played in the house because she thought it had sexy lyrics. And these lyrics would have an effect on my sister, who was entertaining her boyfriend in the front room. Well, whenever Mum was out of the house, my young accomplice, David, remember him? Used to get the record in question by Billy Eckstein, put it on the radiogram. And I'd look through into the keyhole into the front room to see how they were doing, my sister, her boyfriend. And at the appropriate moment, I'd turn up the volume of the radiogram, and the whole house would throb to these sexy, subversive lyrics. That old black magic has me in its spell. That old black magic that you weave so well. Those icy fingers up and down my spine. That same old witchcraft when your eyes meet mine. That same old tingle that I feel inside. And then that elevator starts its ride and round and round I go. Up and down I go. I can leave this cord in the tide. I think my mother was right. Later on, Dave and I took our own records into that front room, early guitar heroes. People like Chet Atkins, Chuck Berry, James Burton, Lead Belly, Charlie Christian. But to me, the greatest of all these guitar players was a blues man from Chicago by the name of Big Bill Broomzy. All of these records played on that radiogram. And when Dave and I had our first rehearsals with our school skiffle group, they took place in that same front room. Goes round and round I go, up and down I go, in a spin, loving that spin I am in, under that old black magic called love. my life, and you can do what you want. Do what you like, but please don't keep me waiting. Please don't keep me waiting, 'cause I'm so tired, tired of waiting, tired of waiting for you. So tired, tired of waiting, tired of waiting for you. Yeah. I was a lonely soul, I had nobody till I met you. But you keep me waiting all of the time. What can I do? That's what I say. Try.
Sounds like a Welsh rugby team in the shower.
Do what you like. I like it. Keep going. But please don't keep me waiting. Please don't keep me waiting. 'Cause I'm so tired. Tired of waiting. Tired of waiting for you. So tired. Tired of waiting, tired of waiting for you, for you, for you,
from New York City, because he doesn't know how to pour a pint of stout. Now, the head is good, isn't it? But not enough of it. I like my head excessive. But this pint of stout, this glass of stout, is not here for no good reason. In fact, I don't even think that's the right way to say it. Anyway, it's my show, and I'll say what I want. This glass of stout is here to remind me of a very important character in my life. My father. You see, my father drank a lot of this stuff whenever he could get his hands on it. In fact, when he'd had about 4 or 5 pints of it, he allowed me to call him Dad. Which I think is quite reasonable. Let's hear it for Dad. Come on. Dad lived for the weekends because that meant he could go to the pub with all of his cronies, drink stout all night until closing time, and everybody would come back home from the pub, back to the front room where Dave and I were rehearsing. Dad would walk in with his friends and go, "Stop that noise! We're going to have a party." See, my dad was a real performer, and his party piece was a song by Cab Calloway called Minnie the Moocher. Yes. Dad fancied himself as a dancer and a singer. You know, it's a very difficult piece to perform, Minnie the Moocher, even when you're sober. But when you've had 15 pints of that stuff, forget it. But Dad wouldn't listen. He cleared the floor, started singing at the top of his voice, tried to balance beer on his head, then slipped ass over tip on the floor, unconscious. And Dave and I would cower away in the corner, completely embarrassed by what we saw. But the girls would come home with the boyfriends, and everybody had a great time. That's everybody except Dave and I, because we were much too young to enjoy this adult world. And we thought to ourselves, how can we make some sort of impact on this very strange family? So we decided to put away the plastic skiffle guitars and turn electric. Yes, make more noise. There's a shop up the road that sold electrical appliances. That's where we thought we'd turn electric. That's right. It was in the window. It was this long and this high. And it was 8 watts in volume. And it was covered in this really awful green formica. But Dave and I liked it. We bought it and we christened it the Green Amplifier. Does anyone know what 8 watts sounds like? 8 watts? Crap. But you know, then we thought it was fantastic. And Dave and I took the green amp home, plugged in our guitars, and practiced day and night.
Yeah, Dave, come on, man! Yeah! Yeah! Come on,
man! What I mean? Searched for a long time for a guitar player that could do that. The girls also had various boyfriends, and Dave and I noticed that one of our sisters went out with a guy who was a bouncer at the local ballroom. And our observations through the keyhole into the front room told us that he wasn't going down too well with my sister. Let me rephrase it for that one. The relationship was not flourishing as it should. But my sister never went down very well. Getting it wrong, she just shut up. But Dave, my brother Dave, he was only 8 years old, but he was already corrupt. And he says to this guy, "Excuse me, mister, if you get me and my brother a gig at your ballroom this weekend, we'll have a word with our sister, and it'll be all right." This guy said, "Oh, thanks very much, son. I could do this or not." You know, this guy was a complete moron. There's no way our sister would have helped our career anyway at all. But lo and behold, the following Saturday night, Dave, myself, and a friend called Pete Quaife, who played the bass, found ourselves on stage playing in front of 1,000 cynical teddy boys. And all three of us were plugged into the little green amp. We didn't have a drummer. We didn't need a drummer. We had the movement. But the teddy boys were not impressed. After somebody threw a pint of beer at us, the management decided to drag us off stage for our own safety, but we were still plugged in as they dragged us off. But the Green Amp stayed on stage, still playing away. You know, the Green Amp came to serve us very well later on. These things often have a way of going round, coming round, and helping you out. front room with your girlfriend and your boyfriend. Songs like Set Me Free. Tired of waiting for you. Maybe, maybe not. I think it was down to frustration of being such a disaster at that first gig we tried to play at. But it was frustration also because we tried to sound like Chuck Berry's guitar on Memphis, Tennessee. Does anyone remember that record? Memphis, Tennessee, Chuck Berry? So it was a great sound on that record. And Dave and I really tried to sound like that guitar. You see, the problem we had is our old radiogram had been played so loud by Dave and I, and so often, that the speakers had broken and the valves were shaking in the back. So every record that played sounded really distorted and fuzzy. You know, that's the way we thought the record sounded. So Dave said to me, how can we make the little green ant sound that distorted? Thought long and hard, and eventually came up with a solution. He took one of Mum's knitting needles and he stuck it into the speakers of the little green ant. And this is before he did drugs. Then he played a chord. It sounded great! Yes, that's the sound! And cracked it. And then Aunt Dave rechristened the green ant the fart box. It's hard to describe the front room, it had a really magical quality to it. Maybe it's because of all those parties that took place there. It always stank of stale beer and cigarettes. But it was really a mystical place. I went to a church school, St. James's Church of England Primary School. Very proper school. But the closest I felt to religion was not when I was in the school choir or going to Sunday school. It was more when I was practicing with Dave in the front room.
See my friends.
my autumn almanac. Friday evenings, we work together, hiding from the weather. Tea and toasted butter, curry buns, can't compensate for lack of sun. Summer's all gone. La 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 la. All together. Oh, my autumn almanac. Yes, yes, yes. It's my autumn almanac. La la. See, growing up in this leafy suburb was paradise. That safe suburban street in Muswell Hill. As I walked around those tidy streets and looked at all those safe-looking houses, I thought to myself, how can anybody possibly be unhappy in such a world? How wrong I was. Behind every little house, behind every window, was heartache, sadness, same as anywhere else. But people pretended that they were happy because they wanted to fit in. Now, to be abnormal in such an environment was not good, as you can imagine. There was a little hunchback man who used to walk around the streets of North London. His head was bowed, forced to look at the ground by this cruel, debilitating hump on his shoulder. My friends, they had a name for him. They called him the Freak. How very imaginative of him. And every time the Freak walked down the street, my friends would laugh. And I laughed with them. Now, my dad was a sports fan. He wanted me to play football for England, which was a real drag because I wanted to play for Wales. But to achieve all the ambitions that my dad had for me, I trained really hard, and eventually I became captain of the school soccer team. No mean feat, really. Until one day, one cold winter's day, playing soccer for the school, I sustained an injury to my spine. Actually, it was a kick up the arse, but I won't go into too much detail. The pain was bad enough to go to a doctor, and the doctor examined me, and he said, "Dear boy, if you don't give up playing soccer, in fact, give up playing all sport for all time, you're going to end up a hunchback like that man I see you laughing at." Yeah, maybe it was meant to scare me, I don't know. But you know, when you're 15 years old and you hear this news, you take it inside. Suddenly, I looked at that hunchback in a new light. He was my future. I was going to be a freak like him. But we all know that ugliness, like beauty, is only skin deep. Don't be fooled by appearances. It only shows what the world already knows. What the extra pictures show. Because inside every straight, upright citizen, a tormented, emotionally impaired, psychologically damaged personality resides. And beside every crippled man stands an angel with wings, and the spirit can do wondrous things. So watch a humpback man hobble down the high street. I say a silent prayer for myself. Yes, so it was taken to the local doctor for a consultation about my physical health. about my family history. You see, Mrs. Davis, it might be hereditary, is it mine? I heard him ask about my family, cause socially it could be we were a physical deformity. Cause the world only sees what it believes in is revealed in the x-ray. It only knows what it knows. Photographs, video, the printed word. But there is more in this heaven and earth that is revealed on the x-ray. Days turned into weeks. Every morning I got up, looked in the mirror at my back. It was giving me pain, but there was no hump. I thought to myself, maybe I should go to Harley Street. That's the posh street where all the private patients have their diseases treated. Maybe it would be administered by a specialist. Who knows? You know, I was quite looking forward to becoming a hunchback. Maybe there would be side benefits. Side benefits like priority seating on football matches, who knows? And I decided if I was going to be a cripple, I would go all the way. And they can photograph it physically, but they can't picture your personality. Cause a word on the scene's what it believes in is revealed in the x-ray. It only knows what it knows. Photograph, video, and the printed word. But there is more in this heaven and earth than is revealed on the x-ray. All the time, the little hunchback walked down on the street, as busy and self-contained as ever. It was obvious to me that my expectations of becoming a freak would be stifled. You see, I would not have the evidence to prove my injury. So I decided, if I wasn't going to be a cripple on the outside, I'd become a cripple on the inside. Then one day, a little hunchback walked up to me on the street. He stopped. He looked at me as if to say, "You are my friend." I was his friend. Then he walked on his way and never said another word. He never spoke. He just got on with his life. From that moment on, you see, he became my hero, my idol. He could handle his deformity. The world is too obsessed with physical perfection, they need the evidence, the x-ray. But I decided that I was not going to be like everybody else. They would take that little crippled man, take photographs of him, examine his crooked bones. But they could not picture the most important part of him, his soul, the only thing that could not be seen or touched. And they could photograph him physically, but they couldn't picture his spirituality. Because the world only sees what it believes is revealed in the x-ray. It only knows what it knows. Photographs, video, and the printed word. than what those scientists know. It is time for you to stop all of your sobbing. Yes, it's time for you to stop all of your sobbing. Ooh, 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 there's one thing you gotta do to make me still want you. Gotta stop sobbing now, yeah. Stop now. Each little tear that falls from your eye makes me want to take you in my arms and tell you to stop all the sobbing. Come on. Yes, it's time for you to stop. It's time for you to stop all of your sobbing. There's one thing you gotta do to make me still want you. You gotta stop sobbing now. Stop it. You gotta stop sobbing now. Stop it. You gotta stop sobbing now.
I did know better at school. In fact, I was so bad at school that as soon as I left, I went straight to college. It was that bad. The Hornsey College of Art and Crafts, with the emphasis on craft and horn. You see, being at art college in the mid to late 60s was quite an experience. The world was changing. Certainly in Britain, it was changing. And the culture was emerging, this new pop culture. It was really felt at art college. There was a new music coming in, music from Alexis Corner and Cyril Davis, no relation, Cyril Davis and his All-Stars. They were playing this music, but it was like Big Bill Broomsey with a backbeat. And I thought, that's for me, that's great, R&B. Art school, though, had a magnetic quality to it. I really loved all the painting, all the sculpture, all the design, and all that stuff. But the thing that drew me to college more than anything else were the chicks. I know people don't think of me as a crumpet man usually. But I'd like to say, I know the word chick is kind of politically incorrect right now. But let's pretend that we're doing a period piece tonight. And I'm speaking the language of that time. They were called chicks, crumpet, tarts, yes! But there was one babe, she was an absolute babe. This woman, this girl, about 17 she was. She was in the sculpture department. She was like one of these film, continental film goddesses, you know. Her body was shaped like a Gretsch country gentleman guitar. And I was no gentleman. And like a Gretsch country gentleman, this babe was out of my price range. But every night I persevered. I carried her easel up the stairs to her bedsit, her little attic bedsit flat. Her books, her paints, and her easel. And once inside, I'd sit down and talk to her about politics, art, literature, revolution, the usual crap. And this babe, she'd lean against the refrigerator, sip her cocoa, and just stare at me as if to say, you can talk all the bullshit you want. You're going to get nowhere. She was right. See, when she was a student, she was a great sculptress. But when it came to me, her real specialty was humiliation. So I'd like to dedicate this next piece to that wonderful prick teaser of my youth. My art school babe, with your pilot knives and brushes, painted face, Egyptian eyebrows and bright red lips, pale white makeup, tight black skirts like Juliet Greco, and there's me, quoting pretentious chat-up lines from Proust, Jean Cocteau, Jean-Paul Sartre. Sitting by a gas fire in a drafty bedsit, the art school babe quotes William Blake as she rolls me a joint. And I think, uh-oh, I've scored. Start to make myself at home, but the room starts moving as she starts to get me stoned. I close my eyes and give in. The room goes in a spin. My lips are dry, I wander around with a ridiculous grin. I grovel on the floor, I think I can make her. Then I wake up and realize I've been kissing the refrigerator. Art school chaps with creative grand illusions. My sketch pad at the ready, my eager stick of charcoal always in my hand. Boring the world for hours with political theories, just to impress anyone who listens, while my art school babe just puts another inch of makeup on her face. And she says to me, "Artie farty, you'll never fool your auntie, who knew you when you picked your nose and wet your pants. How did she know that? Artie farty, I tried to throw a party to impress my peers. I struck a creative stance. Do you like that new game at all? Yeah, delicious. Art school cat, I was really on a mission impossible. I made my play for my art school day by humming jazz tunes with words by Ferlinghetti. Thought I was ever so cool, but I was really such an obvious, pretentious, irritating little fool. For my art school, baby.
Thank you.
sounded fantastic. I said to myself, forget art college. The front room is where it's at. David turned into this incredible guitar player. My little brother had learned all these great licks. The way Dave played the guitar was very similar to the way he spoke.
Get it over here! What do you want to get over here? Get over here! What do you want to do?
Now, I was a pretty good guitar player, but I thought to myself, how can I follow that? And as I said, Pete Quaife's on the bass, so the only way I could slime my way into the band was to become the rhythm guitar player. But we decided not to make the same mistake again. And this time, we'd get a drummer. We took an advert out in the Melody Maker, which is a really big music magazine. A very important new beat group. Require the services of an extraordinary drummer. Auditions next Thursday. The following Thursday, one person turned up. You see, we had forgotten to put the address of the audition. The word had spread by mouth. But this was destiny. This was fate. Because the man, the young man standing before us, was none other than Michael Charles Avery. Round of applause. Mick Avery will be pleased if you remember him, even though he's still wanted in the Bay Area for various reasons. We won't go into that. But there was a problem with Mick Avery. He came from South London. What's wrong with that? We came from North London. That's what's wrong with it. You see, there's more than the River Thames that divides North and South London. It's almost culture that divides us. In fact, North Londoners used to refer to South Londoners as the potato people. And Mick was from the South. But we played a few songs with him, and he sounded pretty good. He thought, yeah, I hope he joins. Mick, though, was a down-to-earth guy. Very ordinary kid. He was a Boy Scout, which is very commendable. But why? Why did he wear the Boy Scout's outfit to the audition? Not very rock and roll, we thought. You see, we looked outrageous. We were dressed in those Carnaby Street clothes. Dave and Pete, particularly, were very influenced by Carnaby Street. Pete Quaife, the bass player, used to stand in the middle, but he was a bit short, Pete. To compensate for that, he used to buff on his hair up really hard on his head and wear these high tube and heel boots and hold his bass up like that. And that would have been fine, but he spoiled it by insisting on wearing a very cheap plastic black cape. Very strange. Pete Quaife was the first male I ever saw wearing eye makeup. There have been many since, but he was the first. And Dave, my brother, only 15 years old, but already his hair was way down his back, and he had these thigh-length leather boots hitched really up as high as he could get them, with a big buckle on his belt. And Dave must have been going through his expressionist period. Because whenever we did music at that time, he insisted on wearing his underpants outside of his pants to give this maximum effect. Weirdo. And I was dressed in those frilly shirts from art college, so we must have looked like a load of pansies. To be sure. And Mick Avery looked at us very suspiciously. And he said, I like the group a lot. I like the music you play. I like R&B. Yeah, it's a common thing, isn't it? But if I join the group, I want to make one thing clear. I've got a girlfriend. And in case you haven't noticed, I'm straight. We can soon change that, darling. Poor old Mick. You know, we tried to explain, we were just trying to get an image for ourselves. We weren't really that faggy, that effeminate. Well, not really. And I said to him, Mick, you know, we need a masculine looking guy in the band, you're absolutely right. Why not the drummer? The drummer should be the toughest, the hardest hunk. You look like one of those movie hunks. You look like Rock Hudson. And that's before everybody knew, to be fair. Mick Avery got his drumsticks, sat in the kit, played away, and thereafter looked as straight as he possibly could. You look at the videos, looking straight at him. And so the Kinks were formed! Yeah! Hey, it's not one of the record bands in this interview, but let's hear it! Come on! Playing in a bar by two very well-respected gentlemen. They were both about 6'5", 6'6", and they were stockbrokers, very, very upper-class people. Pinstripe blue, pinstripe suits, you know the look. Their names were Robert and Grenville. And Robert and Grenville thought it would be a very good idea to manage pop. Don't you think so, Grenville? Yeah, it's a lovely idea. What fun that would be. I've never met anybody like that before. And I said to Robert, Robert, it's fine, but have you ever managed anything in your life before? Never. Perfect, they got the job. They were soon joined by another man. Notice we always do things in threes. He was quite tall as well, not quite as tall as Robert and Grenville, but he was streetwise. He came from East London, which is a tough area. And he knew lots of people in the music industry. His name was Larry. And Larry spoke in a very slow, deliberate way that made you not want to trust him. And Larry always smoked a long Havana cigar. He always had a cigar lit. And he referred to me as Cock. Now, Cock is a London expression for friend, mate, chum, you know. Hello, Cock. How are you, Cock? How's your cock, all right? I could have got a hang up about it, but never mind. Larry was important because he knew people. Robert and Grenville had failed to get us a recording contract, but Larry knew a man, and this man had another contact. And this man got us a 3-single deal with Pye Records. The first single was a cover of Little Richard's Long Tall Sally. It died a death. The follow-up was significant in the sense that it was the first song I'd written for the Kinks. A very naive, optimistic song called You Still Want Me. Unfortunately, nobody did. The third single had to be a hit, otherwise we'd be kicked off the label. I've written another song that we played on stage called You Really Got Me. The audience has loved that because of the dance to it. We thought, yeah, we've got to record this. There's a reaction to it. But the record company hated it. They said, you can't record that song You Really Got Me. We've heard it. You think it's terrible. It's got no melody. Can't hear the words. Hasn't got a riff. And we don't like the sound of that terrible, distorted green amp. Now you can't record it. But Robert and Grenville thought it was marvellous. So Grenville, I think it's absolutely fabulous. I get shivers every time they play. I think it's a hit, Cock, I tell you. I'll stake my entire reputation on it. Now with management like that, how would we say? But the record company said, oh no, we still don't believe in it enough to pay for the session. If you want to record that piece of rubbish, you'll have to pay for the session yourself. And this is cruel because they knew that we were broke. But Robert knew a man who knew a man. And this man knew Robert's father. Robert? Robert had a very distant relationship with his father. You know, they're upper-class people. Why should they mix with their sons? But this man, this intermediary, managed to get a loan from Robert's father of £200 to finance the recording. Here, look what Pater's given me. 200 nicker. Go on, Ray. Go in the studio and record me a hit. Make sure it's a bloody hit, what? So we've got some studio time. The record company said, ah, one more thing. There's a problem with Mick Avery. Well, we knew that. What's the problem? They said, he hasn't signed a recording contract yet. And as he hasn't signed it, well, he can't play on the record. They said this thinking that we'd be loyal to Mick and cancel the session. But we weren't having any of that. We said, okay, if you make us, we'll get a session drummer. Get a session man to play instead of Mick. And they agreed to that. We got a friend called Bobby Graham, who's a great drummer. But at the last minute, we snuck Mick into the studio so they could play tambourine on the record, so the whole band was there. I'd written You Really Got Me as a tribute to all those blues people I loved, people like Leadbelly and Broomzy. And Dave was in the studio that day rehearsing the song, and he played it in the style that I'd first written it. And it sounded a bit like this. We all know the record didn't sound quite like that. But then the session started, and Dave plugged his guitar into the green amp. And then he took the green amp and plugged that into a Vox AC30. And it sounded huge. As Dave played the opening chords, You Really Got Me, they were so loud that the session drummer forgot the complicated little pattern he was going to play on the intro. He just hit one beat on the snare drum as loud as he could. Bah! As if to say to Dave, you noisy little bleeder. I can play just as loud as you can. And I've got a big stick. But that's exactly what we wanted for the next 3 minutes. He sounded like a really loud band. It was halfway through the song, time for Dave's guitar solo. This moment had to be right. So I shouted across the studio to Dave to give him encouragement. But I seemed to spoil his concentration. He looked over at me with a really dazed expression. Fuck off! So I was only trying to help. You don't believe me, do you? No, you don't. I challenge you then. Anyone who doesn't believe me, listen to the original Kinks recording of You Really Got Me. Just after the second chorus, before the guitar solo, there's a drum break. And in the background you can hear... When I did the vocal, I tried to cover it up by going, oh no! But in the background, you can still hear it. And it's even clearer on a CD, it's really nice. But then, Dave looked as if there was something really wrong. His mouth relaxed and his jaw dropped, and he seemed to stop playing. Now, I thought I'd ruined the whole tape. You see, this was halfway through the most important track we'd ever record. And the lead guitar player stops playing just before his solo. I thought that was it. But then Dave's eyes squinted and his face broke into that arrogant sideways grin I've learned to love and hate over the years. And the Lord wrote. You see, he hadn't heard me shout at all. He He's just sort of looking across the studio at me, at the same time as I looked at him. Kind of telepathic way of saying, remember, this is your big moment. Take it. Good luck. But Dave did shout. And he did swear, but you can just about hear it on the record. But you know, it was more at himself to drive himself on to the best possible performance he could. Then he gritted his teeth and cocked an attitude and sneered at me one more time for good luck before turning away into the corner of the studio to play that now legendary guitar solo. Frightfully nice fellow, Brian Epstein. And Brian Epstein liked this funny little band from London called the Kinks. And he liked our distorted little single chord You Really Got Me, with its funny green amp on it. But what Brian Epstein liked most about the Kinks was the drummer. Who, as we all know, was and is straight. Excellent. But Brian Epstein said, "Perseverance, perseverance, I'll not be deterred until I attract the attention of this young battle-east." I'm not quite sure what that means. I understand it's French for drummer. And so, to get close to the band, to the Kinks, Brian Epstein decided to put us on a concert with the most famous group he managed at that time. And the concert we played with, and the band we played with on that concert, was called The Beatles. Now, that very lame response indicates to me that you're either much, much too young. You're either much, much too young, or you ain't seen the anthology yet. You have just seen the anthology, haven't you? The anthology. I travelled all over the world last year trying to avoid it. Everywhere I went, the anthology was on sale. Well, if you still have doubts, I'd like to point out and go on the record right now and say that the Beatles were very, very popular. In their day. The Kinks were on a show with them. What an opportunity to play with this great band. You know, there were lots of other bands on, but the Kinks had the best spot. We went on just after the intermission and played four songs before the Beatles went on. And Dave said to me, "We'll blow them off the stage, won't we?" "You Really Got Me's number 25, isn't it?" "Yes." "We've got the green app, haven't we?" "It's a secret weapon." We got to the theatre and we saw 5,000 Beatles fans screaming. Our legs turned to jelly. We were terrified. During the interval, we were putting the final pieces of our stage gear into place as a photographer set up lights at the side of the stage. He was going to take a picture of John, Paul, Ringo and George as they breezed into the backstage entrance at the last minute. The stage manager had given us a 2-minute warning to do our show, and we were really getting nervous. Then we were distracted by screams from the direction of the stage door. Some of the crew and the hangers-on rushed across the stage and knocked me over. I picked myself up, brushed down my red hunting jacket. I put my guitar on the stand behind me. Then we heard the sound of northern accents and slow, deep, drawling voices, getting laughter from obvious banal comments. I've since discovered that this is a sign of a true celebrity. I've just proved my point. The stage manager delayed the start of the second half while the Beatles did their photo shoot. When it was over, the audience screamed. We waited nervously behind the curtain. Now was our moment. But then the master of ceremonies went out front. And we were hoping there'd be a slight mention from him of the Kinks. But instead the audience was informed that the Beatles had arrived and would be on stage very soon. Then, just to make us feel completely at ease, we looked into the wings. We saw John Lennon and Paul McCartney, or as Mick Avery had rechristened him, Paul McCockoff. "Oh, look, it's Paul McCockoff!" Mick Avery's such a sleaze. There they were, already dressed in those famous colourless Beatles jackets, and I was amazed how familiar they looked.
Yes, they look like they're wax replicas of Madame Tussauds. That's what they look like. Then the unbelievable happened. John Lennon walked on the stage. He looked at me. He smiled. I smiled back. He looked just like he did on television. And he walked towards me, held out his hand. I held out my hand. John Lennon walked straight past me. He was more interested in my guitar that was on the stand behind me. He started playing with the tone control. Now, it's very disconcerting to have a Beatle play with your knob. Is this yours? John Lennon said. Once my mum's paid off the higher purchase, yes, then I'll be mine. See, I thought that that working class comment would impress John Lennon, but he was unmoved. Then as John's arm raised to brush a little bit of dandruff from my jacket, he took a peek through the curtain to look at the audience. I said, "Excuse me, it's our turn. You're on after us." Oh, dear, it's so embarrassing. John Lennon gave a stern look down that magnificent long nose, and his mouth broke into that famous grin. With the Beatles, laddie. Nobody gets a turn. You're just there to keep the crowd occupied until we go on. I got the feeling you really liked me. What do you think? And as he left the stage, he threw one more parting comment at us of encouragement. "Well, lads, good luck. Oh, but if you get stuck and you run out of songs to play, well, lend you some of ours." I wanted to shout out to him, "I don't know any of yours!" But that was no good. We did, really. Everybody knew this. It was too late. The curtain's open. We were on. Hey! Yeah! Smokestack Lightning by Harry Wolf. Dave was in his customary playing pose. Pete Wave panicked as the curtains opened and the strap on his bass had busted. He had to adopt a new style of playing. Mick Avery sat behind his drum kit, looking as straight as possible. All the while, he tried to avoid the loving gaze of Brian Epstein. And I was shitting myself. I was terrified. The audience were heaving, clapping. They started chanting, "We want the Beatles! We want the Beatles! Get off!" Supposed to play "Got Love If You Want It" by Slim Harpo next, but I shouted to Dave, "Dave, play Where You Got Me! Play Where You Got Me!"
What?
Anyone who's heard my brother speak will know he's got a really high voice. But then Dave got the message, and he turned up his amplifier to 11. This caused it to feed back, and the high-pitched frequency cut right through the screams of the Beatles fans. For a moment, they stopped. But then Dave played the opening chords of "You Really Got Me," and they recognised it. They were with us. It's like it was a prize fight, and we had taken one round off the Beatles, who were the world champions of rock and roll. As John Lennon and Brian Epstein watched from the wings, I felt like shouting in my best Liverpoolian accent. "This isn't one of yours! It's one of ours!"
Decided to put a well-respected man out as a singer in the United States. And we were shocked when it went up the US charts. You see, we were shocked because it wasn't like our normal singles at that time. Our regular singles were rock and roll songs like You Really Got Me, Tired of Waiting for You, and my personal favorite, All Day and All of the Night. Which we are not going to play this evening. A well-respected band contained another ingredient. Lots and lots of words. And one word in particular proved that while Britain and America share the same language, many of the words we use have totally different meanings. And I'll sing the verse in question and see if you can spot the word that really caused such an uproar when the record came out. And he likes his own backyard, and he likes his fags the best. Fag, 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 fag. You see, where I come from, a fag is a roller, a cigarette.
Harry Mack,
is it? Yes. Oh, Tom is young and Tom is bold. Tom is as bold as a night of old, but whenever he gets in a bit of a jam, there's nothing he will do to get a Harry Mack. Hey, Harry Mack, Harry Mack. I do anything just to get a Harry Mack. Then I curse myself for the life I've led and roll myself a Harry Mack and put myself to bed. Hey! Yeah. You ask me to do it, I'm going to do it. Oh, bless you, tax man, bless you all. You may take some, but you never take it all. But if I give it all, I won't feel sad, as long as I've got enough to buy a Harry Rack. Hey, Harry Rack, Harry Rack. I do anything just to get a Harry Rack. Then I curse myself for the life I've led. I want myself a Harry Rack and walk myself to bed. Hey! Very innocent, but in America, we discovered that fag means something else. All of a sudden, the Kinks were being invited to play in very exotic locations. Greenwich Village, New York. And San Francisco.
We want the Kinks here immediately!
You can imagine this was a cause for concern to Mick Avery. It's like his worst nightmares coming true.
I shouldn't have joined that group.
But
Robert, on the other hand, and Grenville couldn't see anything wrong with it. Can you see anything wrong with it, Grenville? None whatsoever, Robert. Didn't we fag at school? Well, you know what they're like, aristocrats. They live in a different world. For them, it's nothing. One up the bum, no harm done. And I was so concerned about my macho image, particularly as I'd written the song, that I decided to take action, and I married my childhood sweetheart. And his name was... She was a wonderful girl. So there we were, on our way to America, hoping that people would be shouting for you really got me, tired of waiting for you and all day and all the night, but knowing in our heart of hearts that people would be stopping us on the street and saying, "Are you the Kinks? Sing that faggot song." So to celebrate this momentous occasion, I want everyone to join in with one more chorus of the well-respected man. Come on. And he's a southern man. Confronted this immigration man, this big, fat immigration man. He studied my passport. "Are you a beetle? Or are you a girl?" Hey, when I was a kid, my dad brought me up to be tough. He wanted me to be a footballer. He took me to see all these wonderful, heroic movies, films of the Wild West, with real men. John Wayne, Randolph Scott, Hopalong Cassidy. Actually, I had my doubts about what Hopalong Cassidy was. It was that funny walk, didn't it? And a white horse, give me a break. But John Wayne, the Duke, no way. He wasn't a girl. I wondered what this big, fat cowboy of an immigration man, he's a real redneck cowboy, what he would have done confronting with the Duke. So I assumed the role of the Duke, whatever that was. "I'm a girl. Enter. He gave me a visa for a year. Have a nice time in America, kid. See me on the way out. You know what I mean?" So there we were. We played New York City, a triumph. Philadelphia, a success. And then we drove into the Midwest. And that's when it all started to go wrong. Riding along in the Ford Thunderbird, driven by this slick-looking dude, you could see I was intimidated to be here. He looked at me and he said, "Welcome to the real America." Seen those black and white images from Dallas, Texas when I was a kid. the Texas Book Depository, Lee Harvey Oswald, Jack Ruby. And these black and white images would come back to haunt me on my journey through America. The Kinks at this time had already signed many, many contracts. Many, many bad contracts. And many of these contracts had their homes with American corporations. And we decided we weren't going to sign any more pieces of paper that were put in front of us. Which, as you know, is almost an impossibility with the bureaucracy. Especially when you enter the land of ice cream and apple pie. Guns in the Wild West! You see in a B movie, the kind of punk that would piss everybody off before Lee Marvin did us all a favor and blew his brains out. The punk looked at me. The Kinks. The Kinks. What kind of a motherfucking name is that? I tried to be unimpressed. Then the punk reached over and picked up a car telephone, knowing I'd never seen one of those before. Hey kid. I've got Elvis Presley's phone number. He dialed a number. Hey, is that you, Elvis? I want to speak to the Colonel. Jump to it, you mother. Mother? You call Elvis Presley a mother? This guy was either a bullshitter or he had lots of clout. Then he got really angry, slammed down the car telephone, reached in the glove compartment and pulled out a revolver. I've never seen a real gun before. He waved it around menacingly. You see, kid, when people deal with me, they treat me right. Otherwise, they deal with this. I'm glad he was only waving his revolver. Then he snapped back into that happy-go-lucky B-movie mode. Welcome to Peoria, Illinois, the home of Middle America, ice cream and apple pie. Guns in the Wild West. All American wise guys. White teeth that cream in the sun and burn in the shade. All American blue. Popcorn on the T-ball. Hot dog with a big smile for the bad attitude. Objection to Dave. Hey you! You with the long hair. shirt and a red hunting jacket.
Sign a piece of paper. Sign a piece of paper.
Why don't you take that piece of paper and stick it up your ass?
Yeah. Maybe in certain circumstances that could have been the right thing to say. But on this occasion, it was the wrong guy. You see, he was with the union. Very powerful union. Oh, King calls, King calls, huh? Once I found my report on you guys, you're never gonna work in America again. You're gonna find out just how powerful I am. This is the land of ice cream and apple pie, but also commitment, obligation in the wild west. Lights up the sky like the sun. Great American Union rules with a fist, a smile and a gun. Later, Robin and Grenville were in their offices in Carnaby Street, trendy Carnaby Street in London, while we were on tour in America. And they were wondering, how much money will we make in America? Then a letter is hand-delivered from the American Embassy. Robert opens it.
The American Federation of Musicians Union and Television Artists hereby
pronounce a ban on the group known as the Kinks. The period of this ban will be indefinite. Well, what do you know? A ban from the land of ice cream and apple pie. Could this be the way it would be? Ban from the land of ice cream and apple pie. Guns. Culture shock after culture shock. And this is a very, I've been around town today, it's a very safe looking place. Is that right?
Yeah.
When you get out into the wilds of the Midwest, it's really scary. And you know, I had got married before I left England on that tour. And I think it was about three or four months after we got married, my lovely childhood bride gave birth to a lovely baby daughter. A miracle after 4 months, really. Well, I was writing lots of songs on that tour. When I write songs, I actually believe I'm in control. But what a fool I am to think that. Because there's another writer at work, and that's my subconscious. You see, it puts little clues in the songs about what's happening to me. I actually believe that my subconscious is smarter than I am. It doesn't take much, really, does it? I remember exactly where we were. Reno, Nevada. Now, what can go wrong in Reno? I barricaded my hotel room up. I was so paranoid. I was looking out the window at the casinos. All the neon lights of Reno. Thinking about England, and a song I'd written before I left. When I look up from my pillow, I dream you are there with me. Though you are far away, I know you'll always be near to me. I go to sleep. Sleep
imagine a chair with me. I go to sleep, sleep, and imagine a chair.
I know a man who knows a man. Don't you, Grandpa? And this man is so powerful in the music industry. He can speak to the unions and the immigration people and get your visa returned so you can tour America again. So we fly to New York City to meet the power man. And we take Robert, Grenville, and Larry. And we confront this powerful man in his office at the top of a giant skyscraper. The Kinks. I always wanted to meet the Kinks. That You Really Got Me is a great record. Me and my wife, we dance to it all the time. But before I do business with the Kinks, I want to know one thing about the band. The drummer. He's a fag, isn't he? So without further ado, is there anything I can do for you, my well-respected gentleman? Sorry about the joke.
That's a joke.
Actually, you know why we're here, sir? We're here because we've been banned from America for 3 years. I think we may have done something wrong, but it wasn't that bad. You know, I think they made an example of us.
That's exactly right, they did. They made an example of you guys. But they cut you off in your prime.
Your prime, for heaven's sakes!
Don't worry about it. I'll deal with it. All you gotta do is sign this piece of paper. So we sign. Before you go back to England, Mr. Humble, is there anything else I can do for you? Actually, yes there is. We've got a really shitty recording contract. And the publishing royalties world goes from one side of the world to the other. But the time the royalties come to us, we've got no money left. In fact, the Kinks. Don't tell anybody this, the Kinks have got no money.
No money after all those hit records? That's a disgrace.
Sometimes I'm ashamed of the industry I'm in. Don't worry about it. Just give me the power of attorney. So we sign another piece of paper. We go back to England, back to the semi-detached. A telephone rings. It is my attorney. The lawsuits have started. There's a knock at the door. The writs are being served. The Kinks are in breach of contract. I rush to the telephone, dial New York City. Excuse me, sir. I didn't expect all this litigation. We just want to make records, get a decent royalty, and go on tour.
Kid, remember what I said. You're giving me a piece of paper with your name on it. I have the right to sign whatever I want on your behalf. You told those managers, that Robert, that Grenville, and the other tall streak of piss, that guy Larry. Tell them that the royalties will come in about 10 or 15 years. Till then, welcome to the money go round. Robert owes half to Grenville, who in turn gave half to Larry, who would all buy instrumentals. And so he gave half to a foreign publisher, and he took half the money that was earned in some far distant land, gave back half to Larry. And I end up with half of goodness knows what. Can somebody explain why things go on this way? I thought they were my friends. I can't believe it's me. I can't believe that I'm so green. Yes, I'm on the run. That's how sick of what's going on. And everyone take a little bit here. Money goes round and around and around, and it comes out there. Once they all take their share. But you see a solicitor. The story was heard, the writ was served on the verge of a nervous breakdown. I decided to fight right to the end. But if I ever get my money, I'll be too old and gray to spend it all. And life goes on and on.
Madison Square Garden.
Mr. Ronnie Gosselin and Bill Graham, in association with International Creative Management and, of course, the Immigration Service, have brought these guys back to the United States. And I'm sure you'll all agree, they've been away for too long. Now, just like the door on the record is saying to these people, fellas,
there's no hard feeling.
Now, I can't pretend to understand the music. In fact, I think they're kind of weird. But I'm only the promoter, and we're sold out. So what do I know? Don't say that. Buy the t-shirts at the back afters. Don't be smart. Just like that. So, I'd like everybody in Madison Square Garden, raise the roof for these wacky guys from England. This here is for the Kings! On tour again to America. It's great to go back. We really love touring. It's great to have hits again, but at the end of every tour, everybody's got to go home. We all go home sometimes, back to the semi-detached. But as you get back, you realize there's something wrong. As you walk into the house, you realize it's empty. Because the one you loved has gone. I know everybody gets what they deserve, but why is it that whenever they leave, they always take the best pieces of furniture? Personally, I blame the mother-in-law. She always fancied that three-piece suite. Sometimes it's the thing they leave behind that really hurts. On the floor, in that front room, you find a discarded old vinyl album. And what really hurts is that it was your album. The songs you used to sing together when you were in love. And they've also left behind that old radiogram. So you can be guaranteed to play the record all night, driving yourself mad in the process. And every scratchy old track is a memory. And every groove cuts right to the bone.
Thank you.
After that triumphant return to America, but the disastrous return to the former matrimonial home, the Kinks were invited to play at a very prestigious concert at London's Drury Lane Theatre. This was organised by the British government to celebrate Britain's entry into the European Common Market. Now, I couldn't give a toss about the Common Market personally, and I saw this as an excellent opportunity to perform one night only my own personal protest in the form of a stage version of an album we'd done years earlier called the Village Green Preservation Society. The Village Green concert featured not just the Kinks, but a full-blown orchestra and session singers to perform this new work. And I'd written so many new songs for it that I couldn't remember all the words, so I had them put on pieces of paper scattered around the stage, similar to what I did tonight. But anyone who was there that night picked up on the emotion in the songs. And did anybody here ever go to a Kinks concert? How you must have suffered for our art. Well, anyone who went to a Kinks concert would always know they were unpredictable and sometimes chaotic. And this particular night was no exception. But like I said, there was an emotion in these songs. Maybe it was something to do with the fact that this great empire that lasted 100 years and more is now crumbling and wouldn't be as effective and powerful anymore. Maybe my Village Green were those three villages where I grew up in North London: Highgate, Hampstead, and Muswell Hill.
Out in the country, far from all the soot and noise of the city, there's a village green. It's been a long time since I last set eyes on the church with the steeple down by the village green. 'Twas there I met a girl called Daisy, and I kissed her by the old oak tree. Yes, I did. Although I loved my Daisy, I saw fame, and so I left the village green. I miss the village green and all the simple people. I miss the village green, the church, the clock, the steeple. I miss the morning dew, fresh air and Sunday school. And now all the houses are rare antiquities. Japanese tourists flock to see the village green. Oh yes they do.
And they snap their photographs and they say, "Oh, isn't it a pretty scene?" And my old girlfriend Daisy, you know where Daisy is? She's married to Tom the grocer boy. Do you know why? 10 out of 10. He owns a grocery.
I miss the village green and all the simple people. I miss the village green, the church, the clock, the steeple. I miss the morning dew, fresh air and Sunday school. And I will return there and I'll see Daisy and sip tea, eat cake and laugh and talk about the village green. Yes, we will. We will laugh and talk about the village green.
After that concert, the Kinks had new hope in their career, so we went back in the studio to record another single. But the recording session was significant for another reason, because Pete Quaife, the original bass player, had decided to leave the band. He hadn't told us yet, but when you work with somebody that long, particularly when you grow up with them, you know what they're thinking. People said afterwards it was a lot to do with all the lawsuits, the endless litigation that was going on surrounding the Kings. And in a strange way, it's still going on today, in some strange way. And this freaked Pete out, so he had to get out. He was an original Pete. Pete was in the front room, playing through the green amp with Dave. Pete was dragged off stage, still trying to play Ghost Riders in the Sky. Now he was leaving the band. Dave Death of a Clown Davis was still there, giving it some. Mick Avery still playing the drums, still proclaiming to the world that he was the Strange Mick. And me, alone in that semi-detached, confused, looking through all my address books for old girlfriends' telephone numbers. Robert and Grenville were still there as well, but only just. Rare. This litigation is going on much, much too long. This really isn't anything for a gentleman to be doing. We're outcasts in London society. People are starting to laugh at us in the industry, as if they weren't already. Grenville is very upset. My tailor has just asked me to pay for my new suit in advance. Well, it's time for us to go back to our own kind. The revolution is over. Goodbye, Ray. Goodbye, fellows.
Larry was still there. He could still afford a Havana singer. You know, Cock, I love this band more than life. But it's time to move on to pastures new. Goodbye, fellas. Goodbye, me uncle. Oh, by the way, Cobb, I've discovered a new group. I've signed them on a long-term contract, publishing everything. We're going to the studio next week to record. I think you'll like them, Cobb. They remind me of you when I first met you. Sort of gullible. I'll have to change their name, though, Cop. They're called the Trogs.
So Larry got his big time. There we were on that final session, playing that track for the last time, the Kings, the original band, together. And as we played the song back, you could tell there was a lot in Pete Quaife's mind. Because as he left the studio before the track finished, he wrote the title down on a piece of paper and he misspelled it. D-A-Z-E. Thank you for the days, those endless days, those sacred days you gave me. I'm thinking of the days. I won't forget a single day, believe me. I bless the night. I bless the light that shines on you, believe me. And though you're gone, you're with me every single day. Believe me. Days I remember all my life. Days when you can't see wrong for a night. You took my life, but then I knew that very soon it'd be me. But it's alright, now I'm not frightened of this world, believe me. I wish today could be tomorrow. The night is dark, it just brings sorrow. Let it wait. Those endless days, those sacred days you gave me. I'm thinking of the day. I won't forget a single day, believe me. I bless the light. I bless the light that shines on you, believe me. And though you're gone, going into the night. People so busy make me feel dizzy. Taxi light shines so bright. But I don't need no friends. As long as I gaze on Waterloo sunset, something about the Kinks, and maybe a little bit about yourselves, because in a strange way, we're all unified by this strange phenomenon called pop culture. If you really got me, you got to number one in all the charts. The night you got to number one, the Kinks played a concert in, of all places, South London, the home of the potato people. But now we were friends, because we understood each other more. But the Kinks played You Really Got Me three or four times that night because the audience demanded it. And it was great. After the show, we went towards the bar and I saw my dad. He was there with some of his cronies from the pub as usual, and they'd been drinking a lot. And Dave and I thought, oh no, Crisis Reunited. You'll insist on seeing Minnie the Moocher and not Dad came towards us, and I could tell there was something different about him this night. He was wearing a dashing blue suit, and his hair had been smiled down with pearl cream, especially for the occasion. I thought he'd shake hands with me at first, but instead he came over to me and threw his arm around me and kissed me on the cheek. And I said, Dad? He looked at me and he said, let's get your brother, go to the bar, and get pissed. Which I suppose is quite reasonable in the circumstances. But as we walked towards the bar, Dad stopped and he said to me, actually, son, I'm proud of you. I said, what? I'm proud of you because you do all the things on stage tonight that I always wanted to do and I couldn't. But now I can see that, like me, you are a performer. With one old hand to another, I'd like to confess to you now, son, that my version of Minnie the Moocher was truly appalling. We went to the bar. Dave came to the bar, Pete, Mick Avery, Robert, Gremlin and Larry, because that was a great team. It was like being in a football team, winning the World Series, whatever you win. You really got me. Maybe it should have stayed number one forever. Wouldn't that have been boring? Because then the Kinks would have had that career. The career that went up, 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 and down, and up, and down, all the way here tonight to San Luis Obispo. And I said it right that time. And I wouldn't be able to say all I know about this strange group of people and tell you about the greatest bunch of guys I've ever known. They're really great guys, the Kinks. You've been a great audience tonight. Thank you very much.
It was great.
It'll be, yeah, it was great. Really good.
yeah, he was. It was, you know, we saw the run in San Francisco last night, and that was great. But this was even better, was longer and better.
Yeah, and real quiet crowd.
Yeah,
real quiet crowd. How's it going? Steve, right?
Steve, yeah.
Hi, Mickey.
Yes.
How's it going?
Hi.
Long time. Good, good.
Wow, I didn't even recognize you.
Yeah. Yeah, oh yeah.
How's it like show?
Loved it. It's great. It's great. Do you ever want to give me a phrase? I just think about this. I know you weren't into that laugh when I talked to you, but I've got some. Like I said, I got that one from the board that we did of Joe or Blocker at Camp St. Louis through the board. It's the best blues I've personally done.
Through
the board, yeah, it was great.
I really like the Junior Well.
Good. So this is better. This is better. Cool. Yeah, that'd be good. But one of these days, I want to get one of those CD recorders.
You'll be happy.
You spurned me on.
Yeah, you'll be happy. Just know where to go.
Oh, yeah.
Now, once you do it, it's like 60 cents.
Oh, I know. They're supposed to have a shelf life of 30 years compared to 5 for tape.
I've even heard longer.
Really?
Well, because the regulars, once you provide the store, they're pressed up with the glass master, and they've got a point.
Bye-bye, Mickey.
These are, you cut these, they're on gold anodized instead of silver, instead of aluminum oxidized.
Right.
So these should last longer than we'll live.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah, it's too, right? All right. Have fun down in the concrete jungle.
Such a unique performance. I don't know anybody else that plays anything like that.
Come on, Drew, get to work. See you later, Drew.
Hey, yeah, I got him this side. I'm locked out.
Hey, Abe.
Hey, Rick, something I meant to ask you about that lady was talking about her shirt or something. Did you hear that the Kinks are running back to the
like it.
Do you think the interesting year was situation was good?
Yeah, it was really good. Yeah, it was my first live experience with Ray Davies. Yeah.
With
Limiter? Oh no, I ran it manual.
Oh good.
Yeah, I'm a manual kind of guy. Oh yeah, send me
What was it?
I don't know yet. I haven't checked. It was like hour and 45 minutes on the first one, probably an hour on the second one. I gotta go. My ride's
Brian
leaving.
Already up there? Are you going with Dave?
I'm going. I don't know. Either Dave or Brian. I don't know. So I didn't see you have him sign anything. Did you get it before the show?
No, I was going to, but by the time I got here, he had already been and gone.
Oh, no.
He's in a good mood.
Seems to be.
Yeah.
I'm going to go see if I can
cold.
Catch
it. No, it's not. It was a lot colder before.
Yeah. Well, the wind's not blowing.
My valuable archival role.
Good man. I can't wait to hear it.
Yeah. You still haven't heard the Prine yet, have you?
No.
Oh, that was outstanding.
That was outstanding.
Outstanding.
How many tapes?
Oh.
1.5?
I think it's 1.5, yeah.
All right.
1.5. Especially the guy at the end.
Village Green, thanks, dude.
The guy at the end that says, you know, you're getting quite proficient.
You need a pen?
Oh, I've got one, actually.
Yeah. Well, you are quite proficient. I mean, I still listen to the Dick Dale one.
Good, all right.
It was great. It was a great show.